Okay, so good evening, everybody. We done all the introductions and so on, is that right? Okay, so you all know who I am, and we all come here to do some practice together. It's been a bit of a custom in when I was ever since I've been doing Buddhism, actually, since the first monastery I was in Thailand, we used to celebrate the new year, and then in the monasteries I was in Australia also, we would do some meditation or something on a new year. And it's actually a very nice thing to do, because one of the things, of course, is that, you know, on New Year's Eve everybody likes to go and party and have a good time. Yeah, but of course the good time that people are having is not quite the same as what we mean by having a good time in Buddhism. And when they say they want to go and have a good time, it doesn't mean they want to go and keep precepts and be kind to others and so on. Having a good time means something quite different. So just as we were driving in the car on the way here, I saw one. Can we turn that down a little bit, please? Thanks. How it was before was fine. Yeah. We were driving on the car. Down a little bit, please. Down. Can we turn the volume down a little bit, please? Yeah. Like it was before was fine. Okay. Can everybody hear me at the back there? Yeah? You can hear okay? Yes? Okay. So as we were driving here, we were seeing all the people going out to have their fun, and I saw this one guy walking along the road. He had the shiniest suit I have ever seen. Unbelievable. I don't know maybe it was a safety thing or something, that you can his lights will shine in the dark, you'll never hit him with your car or something, but I don't know. All I could say is that if the amount of happiness that you have is related to the shininess of your suit, then that man is going to be the happiest man in Colombo this evening. So when we come here to practice together, we leave those things behind. Actually, one of the things about parties and those kinds of things is that not everybody likes to do it. And I was just mentioning outside, I was invited last year to Brazil to teach a meditation retreat, and I said, what's the best time to go? And they said, carnival. Yeah, so go to the carnival time in Rio. Why? Because, well, not everybody likes to go to carnival. Some people like to have a nice quiet time. And so while everybody's off dancing in the streets and so on, the Dhamma practitioners have a very strange idea of what a good time means. So for us, a good time means sitting quietly in a room together with our friends, our family, our other fellow practitioners, and not talking to them. It's very strange, isn't it? Just to come and be quiet together. To be content. And so to be here this evening, you've all given up so very much. So many things we could have gone to. So much good times and music and all of those things. And so every one of those possibilities you have given up just to come here. So this is already just showing up. You're already developing your nekama, your renunciation. Yeah? This is part of the factors of the Eightfold Path. This is one of the second factors of the Eightfold Path, is nekama sankappa. And you've already developed that by coming here. So you don't even need to bother meditating. Yeah? You're already practicing just by being here. So meditation then is like the icing on the cake. And so when we're here, we have the chance to practice together. We have so many conditions to help us practice. For example, we have all of the bodhisattvas who are letting off the crackers around us. Yeah? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. It's so wonderful that they've come to help us in our meditation. Stop us from falling asleep. Yeah? Maybe you're sitting there nodding and falling asleep. Bang! Oh, wake up. Oh, thank you, sadhu, sadhu. Maybe this, before too long we'll probably have people starting playing music. More bodhisattvas coming to help us. Remind us, oh, so, thank you, sadhus. Remind us what there is in the world. Remind us of all of these, love and hate and pain and loss and joy and sorrow and all of those things. You know, the things that people sing about. And so if you listen to those things in the right way, it helps to bring, you know, if you get caught up in it and get involved in it, then it becomes an attachment. But actually, it all depends how you look at it. There's one story where it talks about developing the precept of not listening to music, and it talks about a monk who went for a walk for alms in the village, and he heard a slave woman singing about suffering. Yeah? The sufferings of life. And when I read that story, I thought, my goodness, I didn't realize that they invented the blues in ancient India. It's a slave woman singing about suffering. It has to be the blues. And when he heard that song, and the monk reflected on the sufferings of life, and he became an arahant right there. Yeah. So when you hear that singing and the songs start up later, you can reflect. Ah, that love and that pain and that loss. This is what samsara is. Thank you so much to the bodhisattvas who sent me this message. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And so we have all of these things to help us practice. When I was in, you know, when we want to come to meditate, we always want to have a nice quiet place. We always want to have a place with solitude. And just a couple of days ago, I spent a little time in Kandy and had the very great blessing to visit a couple of the forest monasteries and hermitages in that area. And you can see what a beautiful, powerful environment that is for practicing meditation. But actually, you can meditate anywhere. And if we worry too much about the environment and the noise and so on, we can end up missing the point of the meditation. And of course, the point of the meditation is always letting go. In Sydney, there's a group of friends of mine who run a little project they call MedMob, as in Meditation Mob. And MedMob is it's actually an international kind of movement. And basically you organize over Facebook and so on, and then you have meditations in public spaces. So they come into parks and things like that, and everybody just comes together at some time and sits meditation for an hour and then gets up and goes home. That's it. Very, very simple. And we did one of these med mobs in Sydney near to the Sydney Opera House, right? It was right on the harbour, it's in the park there, it's very beautiful. Perfect place to go and meditate, yeah? Except we were on the side next to the freeway, so there's the freeway noise coming, and it's just near the city, so there's all the city noise coming. And that week they were renovating the Opera House, and they were demolishing the steps at the Opera House, so there were all these big machines out there with jackhammers, and smashing. And there we were trying to meditate in the midst of all this noise crashing around. And then when we started the meditation, I just thought to myself, you know, if I try to push that sound away, I'm going to be struggling for this whole hour. Why don't I just sit here and just let it go through me? And you have this idea in Pali, this idea of patigaha, which is an interesting concept. Patigaha, we usually translate in English as resistance. And it both means like a physical resistance when one thing hits another, but also is a word for anger. Yeah? So anger, like resistance, resisting things, there's that force of anger. And so often you can see that subtle patigaha, that subtle resistance when you're meditating. And something happens and you don't like a sound or a thought. And meditation really begins when that patigaha dies away, when that sense of resistance dies away, and then there's an openness. You can let all those things come through you. And this applies not just to the sounds that we hear externally, it applies just as much, even more so, to our own mind. I couldn't count the amount of times when I've talked to somebody about meditation and the first thing they say is, oh, I couldn't stop thinking. All these thoughts are coming. How do I get rid of the thoughts? How do I stop thinking? And when I first started to meditate, that was my experience as well. Mind's thinking all the time. Imagining all of these different things. I remember the first retreat that I did in Thailand. It was in the hot season, and so whenever I meditated, there would be a fan in the room. At that time, I was still a layman. I was a musician, that was my job. And so anyway, I was doing this retreat, and halfway during the retreat, sometimes, you know, your mind runs away with you. And I had in my mind this amazing piece of music. And it was like so incredible, and it kept on going round and round my head, and it was like all of these different parts and coming and going. And I was like, wow, that's the most amazing piece of music that I've ever heard. And then after a while, I realized, hang on, that's just the noise of the fan. There was a story similar to that, the story of a monk who used to live in a hut by a stream. And when he used to meditate in the hut, the noise of the stream would go past, and then sometimes it would sound like a song or a piece of music or something. Anyway, one day another monk walked past, and this monk was in the stream moving the rocks around. And the monk said, what are you doing? And he said, I am sick and tired of that tune. And so a mind will always go inventing and making things up. And when we can spend our whole lives without even noticing this. And I suspect most people do. You go your whole life without even realizing what it is that your mind is doing. Without even acknowledging the possibility that there might be something else. Without even noticing the fact that the mind can be silent. And people talk about, how do I make thoughts end? How do I make them stop? How do I make the thoughts stop? What's that question, really? You strip that question down. How do I make them stop? How do I make them? How do I make? I make. This is the question you're asking. I make. Yeah? I make. In Pali, ahankara. And so, of course, you can't make the thought stop. And this is why people struggle so much in meditation. You can't make thoughts stop. And the effort, the trying to do that, is just more controlling. Again, thinking back to the first retreat that I ever did, that retreat was a very interesting one, because they didn't really give any Dhamma teachings as such. They just taught us how to meditate and let us go and practice. And only very, very brief Dhamma teachings that they gave, and I still remember some of those teachings, and one of the ones that they said was, they talked about not self, anatta. And remember, at this time I didn't know anything about Buddhism. And the explanation of anatta was, cannot control. Yeah, that's it. Cannot control. That's all you need to know. Yeah? Actually, that's straight out of the Anuttalakkhana Sutta, isn't it? The first discourse on not-self that the Buddha taught. And he said that you can't have of your physical form. May it be like that, may it be like that. You can't control your feelings. May you be like this, may you be like that. This is what not-self means. So if we're thinking, how do I make? I make. Then you're just asking, how can I be the controller? How can I be the doer? How can I be the agent? And this is just the self. It's just the ego talking. The secret to finding quiet in the mind is to understand that the thoughts end all by themselves. How can they not? Thoughts are conditioned, like everything else that you've ever experienced in your life. They are conditioned. They begin, they stay for a while, and then they come to an end. So the trick to having a quiet mind is not to make the thoughts stop. The thoughts are going to stop anyway. The trick to having a quiet mind is to be able to accept the thoughts, not try to react to them or push them or make them go away. This is why you can use that training tonight. If we hear the noise and the crackers and the music or whatever we hear this evening, you can use that as a training to let those sounds go through you. You know, it's always something you notice on retreats, and I've just come from Germany, where I've taught a meditation retreat, and like every other retreat, you find that when people have to sit meditation in a room together for many days at a time, people start to get annoyed this person's shuffling around on their seat, this person's closing, banging the door when they come in, this person, and all those tiny little things. Tiny, tiny little things. They open their water bottle noisily. Things that you wouldn't even notice normally. Yeah? And suddenly, that becomes so important. It's the same thing in your mind. All of those thoughts are happening all the time. You don't even notice them. And suddenly when you sit down to meditate, it becomes a problem. Why? Why has it become a problem? It's become a problem because your meditation is starting to work. Because you are becoming more aware. You're becoming more conscious. That is the purpose of meditation. Even to be aware of the fact that you're being distracted by thoughts is already being more conscious and more mindful than you are normally. That's already a more advanced state of consciousness than most people realize in their entire life. So congratulations on being distracted in your meditation. So we are aware of it. You bring awareness to it's a process. It comes to an end. And then you can begin to ask the interesting questions. What happens in that silence? What happens when there's no thinking? You know, there's a saying they say about being addicted to cigarettes, being addicted to tobacco. You say giving up cigarettes is easy. I've done it dozens of times. Right? Giving up is easy. The hard part, not starting again. Yeah. The same thing with your thinking. Stopping thinking is easy. It happens all the time. In fact, it's impossible to not stop, right? I mean, if our thoughts go completely without any break between them, then this is what we call like a psychosis or something like that. The mind is just going running like without any end. Our minds are not like that. Our minds talk to ourselves. We talk to in our own mind, and there are spaces. There are gaps. But normally, our problem is that we don't notice those gaps. Actually, space is the biggest thing in the universe. You walk into this hall, and you think, oh, there's so many people in this hall. But look above everybody's heads. There's all this space. Actually, this hall is almost empty. Just a few people. But even people are mostly empty, aren't they? I mean, we know this from modern physics and chemistry. It's atoms and atoms are mostly space, just energies whirling in space. That's all you are. You think you're solid, but there's nothing there. And if even solid matter is mostly space, how much more so is what's happening in your mind? It's the space in the mind that gives meaning. The more crowded your mind is, the more busy your mind is, the more that there's an endless stream of thoughts, one after the other, then the less valuable those thoughts are. Thoughts tend to reinforce each other. Right? They go round and round and round, following the same old tracks, wearing out paths in our brain. And the more that you think along one track, the less you'll be able to see things newly. The less you'll have imagination, creativity, intuition, insight. So all of these things, real insight, doesn't come from following a method. Real insight is not something that you can teach. Real insight comes when there's nothing, when the mind is completely open, when nothing, when there's no papiga, no resistance. So all of these pathways that we're so used to sending our mind down, the pathways of thought, we open them up. We pay attention to those spaces. And it's from those spaces that wisdom can start to arise, little bit by little bit. And so we pay attention to what's happening in those spaces between the thoughts. And what we find there is something that's quite interesting. We find that what we thought was empty space, in fact, is quite full. I showed this to some of the monks the other day. I have on my computer, I have a screensaver which has thousands and thousands of stars on it. Looks like the Dasasahasi Loka Dhatu. It's full of stars. And it's a really amazing photograph, because that photograph was taken when they had some spare time on one of the radio telescopes. I think it was on the Hubble telescope. And they had some spare time, it wasn't scheduled. And so they pointed it towards the darkest point in the sky, where there's nothing. And they just left it there. And that's what they found. Millions and millions and millions of stars. Yeah, on the blackest point in the sky. Yeah. It's quite amazing, isn't it? Yeah? This is what you find in your mind as well. Yeah? If you find the time to look at the quietest point in your mind, the most empty point in your mind, you look inside that, you see what is there. And when you first look, it looks like nothing. It's boring. Just like if you look at that black patch of sky, it's just boring, there's nothing there. Why would I look at that? Things are interesting. Blackness isn't interesting, emptiness isn't interesting, nothing isn't interesting. What could be more boring? But the longer you look at it, gradually you start to see things. Amazing things. Things that you never thought were possible. You start to see, for example, your feelings. Feelings are something which, in a way, are very ordinary. And we all have feelings, I guess. Does everybody here have feelings? Mostly. The reason I ask is because I was just in Singapore a few weeks ago, and there was a survey done last year of... And they found that Singaporeans were the most emotionless people in the world. And they found about 30% or something of Singaporeans reported having experienced no feelings in the previous 24 hours. So when I went to Singapore, I asked them about this. I said, "Is this true?" They said, "Sadly, yes, it's true." I said, What is it? They said, "We don't have time to have feelings." I mean, you've got to get up in the morning, you've got to cook breakfast, you've got to travel to work, you've got to work hard and do all of these things. When do you have time to feel anything? Maybe you should schedule like half an hour a day to have some feelings in, or something like that. It's astonishing, isn't it? Yeah. Of course, everybody has feelings, but you don't necessarily know that you have feelings. And we certainly don't know what those feelings are. When the thoughts start to quieten down and become empty in the mind, that's when we can start to notice more clearly, more carefully, more meaningfully what those feelings are. In Western psychology, traditionally in Western psychology, they had this kind of sort of dualistic approach where you had like feelings on the one side and intellect on the other side. And it's a bit of a kind of a problem in Western thought, is you have this, it's a bit like this, the opposition between like religion and science, faith and reason, emotion and intellect. And of course, if you have emotion on one side and intellect on the other side, then, well, you can't help but saying one of them is better than the others. Yeah? Intelligence is better than emotions. And next step, of course, is that women have emotions and men have intellect. Which is why men can think properly and women can't. That's all right, it's just your nature to not be able to think straight. So this is how, this is kind of the assumptions that people used to bring to in psychology. But more and more in recent years, that's been, that kind of way of thinking is now completely abandoned in modern psychology, and they've more and more come to appreciate that rather than being opposed to each other, that emotions and intelligence actually work together. And that having healthy and positive emotions are an essential prerequisite to being able to think straight, to being able to see, to be able to understand, to use analysis and reason. And the reason for that is because emotions have the function, the role of unifying, integrating. You know, when you feel angry, for example, everything about you becomes angry. Your posture becomes changed. Your guts feel tight. Your heart starts beating. Your skin gets flushed. Your thoughts are angry. Your memories become angry. Your perception is angry. Your speech is angry. Every part of you is filled with that emotion. And similarly, if you're feeling loving, then your body becomes like that. Your heart becomes open. Your skin, your face, your thoughts, your memories, your perceptions, everything about what you're doing and how you are becomes filled with that love. So this is that role and that function of emotion as integrating, bringing everything together. And this is why emotion is crucial in developing meditation. If we look at how the Buddha described the process of meditation again and again and again, Pamoja, gladness, Piti, rapture, Pasadhi, tranquility, Sukha, pleasure. These are the qualities that lead to stillness of mind, to samadhi. Where is there one sutta where the Buddha said that forcing yourself to sit still in one place without moving for hours at a time is how you get samadhi? No, there is no such sutta. Where is the sutta where the Buddha says doing XYZ method is how you get to samadhi? No, there is no such sutta. Where is the sutta that says that you have to use a certain posture to meditate? There is no such sutta. Where is the sutta that says you have to endure pain and sit through pain? There is no such sutta. All of these things that people, I find it very strange, all of these things that people talk about in meditation. How do you get rid of thoughts? How do you do this? How do you do that? This isn't how the Buddha talked about meditation. How the Buddha talked about meditation again and again and again. How do you find peace? It's through developing these emotions, these positive emotions, bliss, tranquility, pleasure, rapture. These are the things that integrate your mind, that bring everything together. So when we're meditating, if we're peaceful and quiet, we let the thoughts come and let them go. Watch for that space where the thoughts end, and then we can start to be aware of our feelings quite directly. Normally if we're aware of our feelings, we're actually aware of our feelings quite indirectly. We actually infer our feelings a lot from our own speech and body posture. You don't actually see the feeling itself. You get like a sense for it, an overall idea of what you're feeling, if anything. But in meditation, when your mind's quiet, you just look directly at that feeling and you know exactly what it's like. It has a specific quality to it. Not a quality which is changing and so on, but its own tone, its own quality. And that quality affects everything about your mind and everything about who you are. So you just become aware of that. To begin with, we just know it. Okay? Don't try to do anything about it. Don't try to change it. Right? Sometimes the tendency in meditation, we're always in a hurry to fix things. How do I change this? How do I get rid of this? Just be peaceful. Feelings are okay. Don't run away from feelings. Don't expect to be happy all the time. A good meditator knows when to cry. Ajahn Chah said, if you haven't cried, you haven't started practicing. So for those of you who haven't cried in your meditation yet, he's hoping that tonight will be the night. And if you see somebody next to you crying away in their meditation, then you go, sadhu, sadhu, at last they've begun to practice. These are feelings. It's okay. I don't know how many times I've caught myself trying to escape from some feeling or other. You know, oh, I don't want to talk to that person because it'll be uncomfortable. There'll be I won't feel good. Or, you know, if I go and meditate now, then I'm feeling anxious or sad or something, and it will be a nasty feeling. I don't want to feel that. How many times that I've caught myself? And as soon as you realize how stupid that is. And you just go and you sit and you look and, oh, it's just a feeling. It's okay. And one of the things that you notice about feelings is that when we're not aware of them, they have an overpowering influence on everything we do. We're being pushed around by these feelings all the time. Feelings of anger or sadness or betrayal or jealousy or love or lust or whatever it might be. And most people in the world, they have these feelings and all they want to do is satisfy them. And when we have that feeling of awareness, then you can accept it. You can think, oh, I feel sad. That's okay. It's just a feeling. It comes and goes. I feel happy. It's okay. You don't hold on to it. It's all right. It'll be there for a while. And then it'll go. So you just watch them.
And the more that you're aware of these feelings, the less control they have over you. You just get used to watching them coming and going. It's okay. No big deal. And as you begin to do that and have that acceptance in your meditation, then mind gradually starts to settle down. And when we develop a meditation theme, a particular kind of meditation, then through the development of that meditation, it helps us to develop those positive emotional states. And I remember when I first started practicing meditation I was in Thailand in the early 1990s. And when I first began the tradition I practiced in, they were quite afraid of like feelings, especially feelings of happiness. I don't know if you've ever encountered this attitude in meditation, but some meditation schools and teachers are very afraid of being happy. Ooh, it's a pleasure. Oh, don't go there. You get attached. And then the way some other teachers teach meditation in a way that it's very kind of clinical, it's very kind of mechanistic. You do this and you do this and that, and it's this kind of, you do this kind of method. And I always remember it was Ajahn Brahm who was the first teacher that I ever heard of who really started to bring this idea of emotions, positive emotions, into meditation teaching. And of course when he did that, then you realize, well, that's what's being talked about in the suttas all the time. Constantly talking about developing Brahma Viharas, about developing joy. All of the things that lead to peace of mind, to clarity of mind, those things that lead to wisdom, all of those things are emotional states. So as we practice a meditation, whatever meditation we're doing, we need to discover and develop these positive emotions. Emotions of love, compassion, of joy. And each of us needs to find some approach in the meditation which will help us and support us to develop those things. For some people that happens very naturally. Yeah? For some very annoying people, I should have to say. They just sit down and meditate and oh, I feel so happy and blissful, and you go, oh, come on. Most of us have to struggle a bit more. Most of us, meditation's a mixed bag. Sometimes we're happy, sometimes we're sad. Sometimes we're painful and tense, sometimes we're anxious. So you know, when we talk about meditation and we talk about peace and happiness and love and joy, and but that of course that's just... Wow, that's truly a great bodhisattva now. So all of those things, the peace and the joy, this is just the marketing, okay? That's not the reality. You know that. You've sat in meditation before. It's painful, boring, annoying. The mosquitoes come, the noise come, and then the person moves next to you. Right? And then if you look in like the, you know, magazines or posters with people meditating and so on, then they're always so happy and serene. And if you're on retreat, it always happens, you know, when you're on retreat, it's amazing. And you spend all day, people spend all day sitting in the room together meditating. And every person is sitting there thinking, wow, everybody else is so peaceful. And you look around the room and think, you're thinking, oh, they're all sitting so nicely and so peacefully, and only I'm the one struggling. So this is it, this is what the reality is for most people. Some people, you know, very naturally their mind will become peaceful. And that's, of course, that's wonderful, but if you're like that, then don't take it for granted. Yeah? And sometimes you find that people whose minds are naturally very peaceful, they don't realize what a blessing that is. It's just natural for them. They sit down and meditate and minds full of light. And when I was staying in Malaysia, in Ipoh, we had one family who used to come and bring the dana every day. And one day, it was three sisters would come. And one day, one of the sisters said to me, Bhante, I have a problem I want to ask your advice about. And I said, sure. And she said, well, when I go to sleep at night, I lie down, you know, I try to lie down mindfully, and I watch my breath going in and out. I said, that's good. She said, yeah, but as I watch my breath going in and out, it becomes more and more clear. And more and more clear, and more and more clear, and it becomes very bright. And then this light comes into my mind, and then my mind's like full of this light. And then that light lasts all night, and I can't ever get to sleep because my mind's full of light. And then I just get up in the morning. And I said, do you feel tired the next day? She said, no. I said, I don't think it's a problem. So for some people it's like that. But if we're not like that, it's okay. Many different ways of practice, the Buddha said. There's the Sukha Paripada, the pleasant way. There's the Dukkha Paripada, the painful practice. It's okay. As long as it's practice. So even though when we're sitting, when we're meditating, there will be many times when it's like that. Many times when it's boring, or we don't feel at all peaceful, or we feel, you know, we're not getting anywhere, or you feel frustrated, or you're full of doubts, and all of these things. That every meditator has been through that. Even those very lucky meditators who just, you know, just slip into it. How do you think they got there? Yeah, because of their practice in their past lives. Even the Buddha had to struggle very often with meditation. And this is one of the things I find most inspiring about the suttas. And often when we read the life of the Buddha and the stories of the Buddha, it sounds like the Buddha is he's so beyond, he's so different, he's a kind of this legendary figure. And yet when you read the Buddha's own descriptions of his practice, he was very down to earth. And sort of like, for example, the Upakilesa Sutta, where he comes to visit a group of monks and says, how's your practice going? And they say, well, you know, we're sitting there, our meditation goes well, and then our mind gets restless, and the meditation deteriorates. And the Buddha responds by saying, yes, I know exactly what that's like. The same thing happened to me. He's not putting himself on a pedestal. He's not saying he's different. He's saying, my practice was exactly the same. And he goes on and lists a big long list of all of the defilements and problems that he had to overcome in his own meditation. Restlessness and over anxiety and pushing too hard and being too lazy and all of these things. And he had to struggle with those things before he could bring his meditation together. And so just remember, anything that you experience in your meditation, the Buddha has been there. He knows what that's like. He's experienced all of those things, and he never gave up. All of the great arahants, the bhikkhus, the bhikkhunis, they also have been there. They've experienced those things and they didn't give up. So we just be patient. We let everything come and go. Don't fight it. Don't resist it. You just accept it. somehow, in the midst of that, while all these things are happening, then we look for that place of peace, that place of happiness, that place of joy. Somewhere inside ourselves, there is a place of peace. Those of you who have been meditating for a while, who found that place of peace, will know what I mean. Often I talk to people in about their meditation, and some people will say that they practiced many years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and they had this amazing meditation, and they've been trying to get back to that place ever since. Of course, you never get there if you try to get back to it. But it's such a powerful experience. You never forget it. What is it like to feel real peace? What is it like when all of that suffering, all of that dukkha, just ends? It doesn't end because I make it end. It ends because it's conditioned. Because it's going to end anyway. Nothing we can do about it. Just be aware. And we find as we go deeper and deeper into the meditation, the pleasure, the bliss, the happiness becomes deeper and deeper. Actually, even this word happiness that we use is not adequate. What word can we use in the English language? Pleasure or bliss or rapture? We use all these words, joy, gladness. None of them capture what that feeling is, because all of those words are just talking about everyday states of mind. And in meditation we experience something which is not an everyday state of mind, but still we have to call it something, so we call it happiness or pleasure or bliss. And why is it that when we want to be happy, we think we can be happy by going out and getting things, having things, owning, using? And yet, here in the meditation, finally we realize what true happiness is. Real happiness. Where has that come from? It has come precisely at that point when we have stopped wanting, when we've stopped getting, when we've stopped having, when we've stopped being a self, being an I, being me. That moment is so subtle. You can't produce it, you can't make it happen, you almost wouldn't notice it. But suddenly something just stops. Just so small. Something so small in the mind just stops. A little bit of holding on, we've managed to let go of, and the mind becomes peaceful. And that peace of the mind that we experience is not something that you make. Right? Don't get conceited about it. It's not you. That's just the Dhamma, that's all. That's how the mind works. We hold on, it leads to suffering. We let go, it leads to peace. We've all come here together this evening to practice the Dhamma. That peace of mind is our heritage. This is what was promised to us by the Buddha. If we practice in accordance with the Eightfold Path, then that we will inherit that peace. We will know what that peace is. It's not you, it's not me, nothing to do with us. It's just the Dhamma. Okay, so let's do some meditation for now, and we'll do maybe 1 hour meditation, and then we can have a break for a cup of tea and so on, and then we'll come back after that.